You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On America's Test Kitchen, Chris Kimball and other test cooks solve everyday cooking problems, developing recipes that should work every time. They test home kitchen equipment and taste supermarket ingredients so you'll know what's best to buy. The complete America's Test Kitchen TV show cookbook, published by America's Test Kitchen, includes every recipe from the 10 years the show has been on the air. And I'm pleased to welcome Chris Kimball back to our show today to help answer your cooking questions and aid you in avoiding holiday meal calamities. Welcome back to our show.
A pleasure. Thanks.
And later we will be taking calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. What exactly do you do to test recipes in the test kitchen to come up with the best version? Do you make a lot of bad food before you go with something that's decent?
we're this central place in the world for bad food. I mean, really, it turns out, I've been doing this 30 years, that I've figured out it's not so much coming up with the best version. It's figuring out what people will do with your recipe at home. So it's the most foolproof version. So we start with we find 30 or 40 recipes for chocolate cake or pie pastry. We'll find four or five of them that are diverse enough in their approach. They're interesting. We test them. We cobble together a recipe. We make it 40, 50, 60 times, sometimes 100 times. We send it out to a bunch of our readers and viewers, have them make it. They get back to us. We read what they say, and then we fix it if there's a problem, and then we publish it.
Well, you must have some ideal chocolate cake in mind when you're doing that.
Well, that's where it's mostly objective, but there is a subjective part. If you do brownies, for example, you do cakey brownies, fudgy brownies, chewy brownies, cream cheese brownies, raspberry brownies. There's a lot of different styles. You have to arrive at a style. Once you arrive at a style, it's interesting. People's tastes are fairly consistent. So if you have 30 people taste it, most people will agree on what they liked or did not like. So people always say, well, cooking's so, you know, subjective. I would say it's about 80% objective, and really more objective than subjective.
Actually, we had a pie contest here at WNYC. Some of our the people here baked pies, and there were three judges. I was one of them. And we were shocked because we agreed on all the pies. We all chose a certain pie to be the best. We all chose the one that was the worst, and we chose everything in between.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I guess that is true. But where are you getting these recipes? Are you getting from cookbooks?
We have a big cookbook collection. There's the Schlesinger Library in Boston we use sometimes. We actually go online to do research as well. I would say mostly out of cookbooks. But you know,
so that these are a lot of bad recipes in cookbooks.
Did I say that?
Well, not all these recipes work well.
I think the problem is when someone does a cookbook, the recipes work for the author. Let me give an example. We just did a recipe a year ago for chicken breasts that were sautéed. And one of the people at home sent back a comment saying it was the worst chicken breast he'd ever had in his life. So we were a little concerned, and we read the comments at the bottom where you can add stuff. And he said, well, you know, I didn't have chicken. So I substituted shrimp. Well, if you cook shrimp for 40 minutes, it's going to be a little tough. So, but that's my problem. So people never, ever make a recipe without changing something, a substitution. And that's sort of that's what we do.
Is that where the most common recipe problems come from?
First of all, people, as I said, they'll always make substitutions. For example, if you have a cut of beef and it says top sirloin and you use top round, well, you're going to be in trouble. Or use chuck instead of something else. So, yes, I would think that's the first thing. And the second thing is people at home, there's certain things people do. They don't add enough salt. They don't heat their pans up enough, so they don't get enough sizzle and smoke going. So there's a number of things people tend to do, unless you say to them, be very sure to heat up your pan, here's how you do it, then they'll have better results.
If something isn't quite right, maybe the texture is off or the flavor isn't what you'd hope for, how do you go about determining what the problem is?
We isolate a factor at a time, and so we'll have a control. It's just like a laboratory. We'll change the kind of flour. We'll change the kind of chocolate, for example. We'll change the ratio of fat to flour, et cetera, the kind of liquid. And we'll just keep testing and testing and testing.
When you say you change the kind of chocolate, are we talking brand names or the way the chocolate comes?
Well, one of the problems with chocolate is when it says 60% cacao or 70% cacao, it just means that 70% has more chocolate and less sugar. That can radically affect the results. So in most cases, we're not talking brand as much as we're talking style. Although sometimes certain brands are just higher in cacao, and that will actually affect the results. You actually have to change the recipe. So a lot of people will say, well, gee, 70% of something is better than 60%, so they'll just go out and buy the 70%. Happens all the time. And in fact, it's not better. In fact, I don't really like 70%. I prefer 60 or 65.
Well, 70% may taste better if you're just eating the chocolate. But if you're cooking with it, maybe there's...
Well, there's less sugar in it, so it's going to change the recipe. And sometimes that'll change the texture, too. So.
Now, what about wine? If a recipe calls for a dry red wine, I've been told that you can buy the cheapest red wine as long as it's dry and it'll be perfectly fine. There are some chefs who insist that if you don't use a good red wine, then it's just not going to taste as good.
We actually proved absolutely... The cheapest wine for sangria was the best. We actually tried the $30 bottle, the $5 bottle. I think with red wine, we just put it in a sub-simmer, reduce it down from a cup to a few tablespoons, use a cheap Cote de Rhone, medium-bodied, a little bit of fruit, not too tannic, reduce it down, and it doesn't matter how expensive the wine is if you do that.
Because once you cook it and the alcohol is out, it's something else anyway, isn't it?
It's like heating olive oil. You know, people buy $30 liter olive oil, they put it in a pan to heat it up. Well, they could have used canola oil because all of those volatiles have disappeared when you heat it up.
So you're saying I can use canola instead of extra virgin olive oil when I'm
if you heat it,
garlic?
Oh, yeah, I would never. In Italy, that's what they had, olive oil. So they used it for everything. They would splash it on food. They cook with it. Well, it was cheap. It was local. Here, if you buy a good extra virgin, you would never cook with it. I mean, you'd put it on food, use it in a salad dressing, et cetera. Put it on fish when you've cooked it. But if you heat it up, all that money you spent just goes up in the air.
Can you use it also instead of butter?
Sure. I mean, if you use an inexpensive olive oil, fine. You could use it instead of butter, sure. Sometimes you want butter and olive oil because you want the browning properties of butter or the flavor. But I wouldn't spend $30 on a bottle and then put that in a pan heated up.
My guest is Chris Kimball, whose latest book, I guess we can say that, is the Complete America's Test Kitchen TV Show Cookbook, including all every recipe for 10 years that the television show has been on the air. You also include equipment. You try out equipment and gadgets, and it seems like there's always some kind of new tool that's supposed to make cooking quicker and easier. How many of those gadgets are really necessary in the kitchen?
12%. Some
really?
Small number. Well, here's the category. Stuff you really got to have. You got to be able to sharpen a knife, and a sharpening steel doesn't really do that. So you need a knife sharpener. You need a good knife. You need a garlic press.
You need a garlic press? Can't you chop up garlic or smash it?
Yeah, but most people find it much easier to use a garlic press. And if you press garlic, you get a much stronger garlic flavor because the cells are being crushed, whereas if you mince it, for example, you don't get as much garlic flavor, so it's easier for people. You need, as I said, a good instant read thermometer, and you need a microplane zester for zest, et cetera. But, do you need the electric pizza oven, or do you need the $200 toaster ovens, which are a total waste of money, or do you need the silicone poaching pods? Well, no, you don't really need that.
And just the other day, the Times had an article about people who are now getting the sous vide equipment in their homes. And I don't remember how much it is, but it's an awful lot of money.
Yeah. Well, it would be like I was at Williams-Sonoma a couple of years ago in San Francisco. They opened a new headquarters store. It's a lovely store, but I noticed on the wall or in the wall was a $7,000 wall-mounted gas grill. Really. I mean, so Julia Child did not have a $7,000 wall-mounted rotisserie gas grill in her wall. She didn't need it.
Well, we in New York, we're working in rather cramped kitchens in most cases. Your test kitchen is enormous with room for everything and a lot of people to move around at once. So even if we all have just the right amount of equipment, if two people want to cook sometimes, they can get in each other's way.
Well, there was a couple of cookbooks out years ago about how the French cook in Paris. And if you looked at those little tiny kitchens, they have, as you said, just like New York, very small kitchens. And they don't have fancy cookware, and they, for the most part, turn out very good food.
Does equipment matter when it comes to cooking? Don't certain pans cook better than others?
Absolutely.
I've always wondered about those pans you can get it for $5, and then there are other ones you can get for $500.
Price is not everything, But when you get to a skillet or a saucepan, All Clyde, for example, you know, they don't sponsor our show, but they make very expensive, very good cookware. It has aluminum sandwich with stainless steel top and bottom. And those can run $150 to $200 for a skillet. They retain heat well. They heat up evenly, which is something else you want. Cuisinart's actually just came out with an improved model, which is stainless steel on the top and then aluminum below it. And those run about $50 to $60 for a saucepan, and those are pretty good. So, and there's a couple other brands that do pretty well. But overall, a good 12-inch skillet, a good 3 or 4 quart saucepan is worth the investment, definitely.
What about nonstick?
Nonstick is about 70% of the cookware market today, and most people use nonstick when they shouldn't. The problem with nonstick is if you saute chicken or meat, it will not create a fond. It doesn't stick to the pan. When it sticks to the pan, you get those little brown bits, and that obviously is the basis for a quick pan sauce. So nonstick is great for eggs. It's great for seafood. It's lousy if you want to saute meat or chicken and then get a pan sauce afterwards. So most people use nonstick when they shouldn't, but when you need it, you need it.
I also don't like to cook pancakes in nonstick. I don't know. It just doesn't taste right to me. The crunch isn't right.
Yeah, nonstick. And by the way, you know, I've done tests of nonstick where I've heated it over 500 degrees and it will start to smoke. So you have to be a little bit careful about it.
Oh, you can actually make it. Does the surface actually come loose?
Over 500 degrees, it'll start to smoke, and you can get something called polymer fume fever, which gives you a headache. I tested that myself. And over 600 degrees, I think the material actually starts to break down. So you don't want to heat up a nonstick skillet with nothing in it over high heat and walk away.
And this, in a little while, we'll start taking calls from our listeners. Our number here is 212-433-9692. We also invite your comments, questions on our show page at WNYC.org. But I want to address something since it is holiday season. Although we miss Thanksgiving, people will be making turkeys again for the Christmas holiday. The old brining question comes up, the question of whether you stick the stuffing inside the turkey or you bake it separately, and what you do when the dark meat cooks so much faster than the white meat.
Quick answers are 1 cup of table salt per gallon of water. Put the turkey in, keep it cool 6 to 8 hours, rinse it off. That brines it.
You can use a kosher chicken as well, which is automatically brined?
You don't have to brine it if it's kosher. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, a kosher chicken or turkey is a great way to avoid that. And frozen butter balls, by the way, are injected with a saline solution, so those don't need to be brined. The other possibility is dry brining, which is rub under the skin with salt and let it sit. Stuffing, in general, we tend to cook the stuffing outside. If you want to cook inside, preheat it. Put it into a stuffing sock, which is cheesecloth. Heat it to about 140 in the microwave. And then, obviously, it's hot. Be careful. Then stuff the bird. That way, the stuffing gets a head start, and you won't overcook the white meat by the time dark meat's done. Third question was white and dark meat. You can take the backbone out, spatchcock it, as they say, and roast it that way, which gives you even meat, or start breast side down for 45 minutes, then flip it. And that'll also give you more even cooking.
A lot of people buy frozen turkeys at the supermarket. How do you get the thing to defrost without
it's 5 pounds a day
in your kitchen?
Well, actually, we had a turkey show up because our next-door neighbor in Vermont grows the turkeys that we eat. And she showed up 2 days before with a completely frozen 22-pound bird. But it's 5 pounds a day in the refrigerator. Or put it in a large container and fill it and have cold water running in it constantly or change the water every 30 minutes, and that'll do it quickly.
Should you use a meat thermometer when you cook your turkey?
I use an instant read. It's not stuck in the bird. Those little things that they come with, take those out.
Things that pop up?
Yeah, they pop up around 175 to 180, which is much too high for the breast meat. You want the breast meat about 165, but the thigh, leg, you want at 175. There's a ThermoPen makes a very good instant read thermometer. It's very expensive. You want to take the readings in the breasts and also the thighs and take 3 or 4 readings to figure out where you are.
We will be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. My guest is Chris Kimball of America's Test Kitchen, among other things, Cook Magazine, which has just been discontinued.
What?
Has it?
Oh, I hope not. It was.
Oh, good. I'm glad it hasn't.
I think that was Gourmet, as I remember. Let's not get confused here.
I somebody sent me a thing saying, well, you can't trust anybody anymore, can you?
I know, it's true.
And you can't trust any of the claims that people make
that's also
when they're developing equipment or when they're selling you a product to be cooked in the kitchen. Well, anyway, America's Test Kitchen, their latest book is a complete America's Test Kitchen TV show cookbook. Again, our number here, 212-433-9692. We'll be back right after this. We're back with Chris Kimball. The America's Test Kitchen people have put together their latest cookbook, which includes the 2010 season of the show, the complete America's Test Kitchen TV show cookbook, 2001-2010, every recipe from 10 years of the hit TV show with product ratings and a look behind the scenes. We will be taking your calls in just a moment at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a question or a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. So 2010, the show's already been shot?
We shoot in May for the following January. We shoot 26 episodes in about 3 weeks, and we'll start running in January.
Now, on the show, the cooks have all their ingredients laid out in bowls ready to go. Is that really a time saver? Is that really the best way to work?
It's the only way to work. I mean, what happens, and I've done this for years too, you get the recipe, you haven't read it, you find ingredients as you're cooking. The cream cheese isn't the right temperature, the egg's at the wrong temperature, the garlic isn't minced yet, things are burning in the pan. So everything is put on a plastic cafeteria tray. We use glass bowls. Everything's sorted out depending on how the recipe uses them. And then we have a copy of the recipe on top, and that's how we cook.
Well, if you don't do that, something that I have seen happen more than once, maybe I've even have it happen to me more than once, I realize after the thing is almost two-thirds done that I
forgot
left out an ingredient.
That happens to me
and then,
all the time.
Then, I don't know, do I throw it in now, or is that just going to screw everything up?
The problem is if it's baking, you can't recover. But if it's a stew or soup, you're fine.
Antonio from Park Slope left a comment on our show page. He says, how do you get the bottom of the pie crust perfect? Sometimes my pie crust bottoms come out a tad doughy.
Two things you can do. If you're baking and it's not a pre-baked crust, it's like an apple pie where you put the crust in with the filling at the same time, put the use a Pyrex dish and put it on the very bottom rack of the oven. It gives you a lot of extra heat. In some cases, you get a very crusty crust. The other thing you can do is pre-bake a pie crust if it's a single-shell pie. Refrigerate for 40 minutes, freeze for 20. Put in a 380, 375 oven for 20 to 25 minutes with aluminum foil and some weights, and that'll do it.
Yeah, there are people who have those pie weights and all of that. Do we need to buy that stuff?
You know, we've actually
just down?
It's a good question. We just tested that, and it turns out if you use a double layer of aluminum foil and dock it, that is, use the tines of a fork and make little holes all over the pie crust, you actually can get away without the weights.
Let's take some calls. Our first caller is Margaret from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Lenny. Hi. You know, just this past weekend, I was shopping for like a cast iron casserole Dutch oven, and I was looking at the Crusette and Emile Henry pans, which, like, they are $350. And then I started seeing some that were these off-brands for $50. And I'm just wondering, how do they all compare?
It's a good question. Le Creuset does run well over $200. They come in nice colors, though.
They're beautiful.
But
they're
really for that much beautiful money, you'd expect a nice color.
And they call them heirlooms, so you pass them down through the generations.
Well, if it's $300, it's better be heirloom.
Yeah.
So you can go buy a Dutch oven from Lodge or one of the other companies for $40, 6 or 7 quart. If you keep it oiled, it's fine. The other thing you can do is, I believe, Target it makes a Dutch oven for around $45 or $50, which is a very good deal.
And are they going to rust?
No, the Target one is enameled cast iron like the Le Creuset, and
okay. That
actually is a very good deal if they still sell them. The Dutch oven, the secret is to heat those things up on high for a few minutes on the stovetop, take it off, carefully rub oil into it, do that 4 or 5 times to season it, every time you use it, don't use water to clean it out if you can avoid it. Put oil in the bottom, a little salt, and clean it out, and then season it. So if you keep it seasoned, they won't rust out.
Not just a Dutch oven, and any kind cast of cast iron frying pan.
But and don't give it to my wife.
Yeah. The enameled ones, you still do the same thing with those?
No, enameled has the beauty of you don't have to worry about rusting. You don't have to worry about acidity coming in contact with the iron. However, even Le Creuset will start to turn dark at the bottom. You never get them fully clean. So that they won't look great after a couple of years, but they'll still cook fine.
Thank you for your call. I've always wondered about that. The bottoms of my frying pans always start to discolor, and I think I just haven't cleaned them well enough.
Well, the enamel cast iron on the TV show, we actually have to buy all new Dutch ovens every season because after a year, we use them, you know, obviously 10 hours a day. They get very dark and, mm-hmm. and messed up, but it doesn't hurt the cooking property.
Adam from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? I'm a doctor, and I just had a question about the olive oil versus, you know, not so worth frying with. You said it's about $30 a bottle. If you would have switched to canola oil, though, I think you'd be going from a monounsaturated oil to a polyunsaturated oil, which doesn't have the same health benefits.
As far as
coronary artery disease and all that.
It's fine. Look, you can cook with olive oil. Just don't buy expensive extra virgin. If you just go buy a standard supermarket olive oil, go ahead and cook with it. It's fine. I'm just saying if you're going to get a boutique oil. And by the way, most of the olive oil shipped from Italy is not the highest quality. You're not getting.
They keep it for themselves?
first of all, if you look at the label, it says Italian olive oil. On the back, it may be made from Spanish olives or olives from Greece or some other place. Secondly, there is a history of adulterated olive oil, hazelnut oil from Turkey, lots of other things. So Columella, for example, Columella is my favorite oil. Our favorite oil at the Test Kitchen is from Spain. So just because it's expensive and just because it's Italian doesn't necessarily mean anything. So I would buy a relatively cheap oil to cook with, and then I would buy a very expensive, really good oil for drizzling.
Well, isn't canola oil also polyunsaturated?
I believe so. There's a new oil out right now, which is rice oil, which we actually just tested, and we love that, too.
That works well?
Yeah, we really like it.
The same as the other oils?
Yeah, we just did a test in the kitchen, and it was our favorite.
My guest is Chris Kimball, and the kitchen he's talking about is America's Test Kitchen. The complete America's Test Kitchen TV show cookbook has just been published, including every recipe from the 10 years the show has been on the air, including the upcoming season. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Linda from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
I was calling because last Christmas I decided to try making those really thin ginger cookies that I just love, and I thought, hey, why don't I try making them? And I found a recipe that used not just brown sugar but also dark corn syrup, and the recipe warned me that it would be a sticky dough. But in fact, it ended up sticking to everything, to the counter, to my rolling pin cover, to the rolling pin itself, to the counter, to my hands. And I tried putting the dough back in the fridge to keep it cool, but basically as soon as I started trying to roll it out, and it has to be quite thin, it would just heat up and the dough would just start sticking. And I was just wondering, is that the way that a dough with dark corn syrup behaves, or was I doing something wrong?
Corn syrup will bake up differently, and because sugar and corn syrup are very different in terms of their baking properties. Sugar is hygroscopic, which is a little bit different, and you probably will end up with a stickier dough. We also have trouble getting them off the baking sheet or using parchment paper or what?
They came actually when they baked up. They literally almost popped off of the baking sheet.
And so the results were good when you baked them?
Yeah, they just were so frustrating. I mean, I ended up using like only, I don't know, a quarter of the dough because it just became so unwieldy.
Well, one thing you could do is you could use two sheets of parchment paper or use plastic wrap. Sometimes we do that with a very sticky pie dough. So you could roll it out in between those layers, and that actually will help.
But the recipe didn't alert her to that.
Well, there we go, back to the testing issue, right? So I would roll it out between two layers of plastic wrap. Try that.
Great, thank you.
Okay, thank you so much for calling us. And again, our number here is 212-433-9692. A listener asked, does meat keep cooking when you remove it from the heat? I know the answer to that.
Sure.
Yes.
Well, it depends. It's interesting. If you take a chicken out, the chicken, because it has a lot of airspace inside, that actually won't rise in temperature. But if you had a 3 or 4 pound, you know, solid roast, a beef roast, it definitely will keep going.
And is that why they say let it rest because it's...
No, the main reason is because if you cut into a roast, we've done this on TV, right after it comes out of the oven, the juices will spurt out. They just flow out like a river. If you let it sit 15 or 20 minutes, the proteins change, and that liquid is actually held inside the roast. So you just lose a lot of liquid if you cut into it quickly.
Our next caller is Melissa from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you today? Just want to mention first, actually, for the post, the caller was asking about the gingerbread. I have that problem, too, but I just freeze it in small batches and roll it out in small batches, and it makes it much easier.
That's a good idea.
But the reason for my calling in was, I wonder if you've ever tested Swiss Diamond as a nonstick. I picked one up a couple of years ago sort of by accident, and it actually does give you a very nice fond on the chicken and meat.
This is the manufacturer of nonstick skillets?
Yeah, it's called Swiss Diamond. It's quite expensive.
Like how expensive?
Like, I think the 12-inch saucepan saute pan might have been $140.
Well, that's in keeping with the upper end,
right?
Products. No, we've never tested, never heard of them.
Yeah, it's great. You really,
okay.
And you can also put it at much higher temperatures in the oven than regular.
Does it have? And does the surface look different than a normal nonstick?
Okay. Their shtick sort of is that it has diamonds embedded in it, and that you don't have the toxins that other nonstick has, that they don't get released and so forth.
Wait, they have diamonds?
I don't really care, but it really works very well.
Diamonds on the soles of the skillet. Yeah. The old
right.
song. I guess we have tested some other types of green pans, which are supposed to be nonstick but doesn't have that chemical. And the problem we've had is they're not really very nonstick. That is, if you cook eggs in them, have you tried scrambling eggs in it? I mean, it might be good with meat, but it's lousy with something that you really need nonstick for. So we've tested a few brands, and that's been the beef with them, is that they actually aren't. They're low stick, I think,
right.
is the technical
But term. Yours is totally nonstick?
Yes, this Swiss Diamond is just... I literally bought it once just because I needed that size skillet and I was traveling. And
well, you know what you should do? Just scramble some eggs for dinner and see if they stick.
Okay.
I'd like to know.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you so
Bye.
Much for calling us. And we go now to Kyle from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. Quick question regarding anodized aluminum marketed as nonstick. I have a 14-inch skillet nonstick. Is that any better or worse, or how does it compare to the Teflon nonstick?
Anodized is not nonstick. It's low stick. And anodized simply means that the surface is a lot smoother than a regular pan. If you looked at a microscopic close-up of a regular pan, a lot of peaks and valleys and holes and things. Anodized means that it's a lower stick. It's smoother, so food is less likely to attach itself. But that's not really nonstick.
Okay?
Okay. Does it have any problems with the nonstick problems with heating up too hot or hitting 500
now,
or 600 degrees?
I think that anodized is less problematic than the nonstick coating.
There was a time when people were concerned about cooking with aluminum cookware. Have we gotten past that?
No. There's been a lot of studies done, and people think that Alzheimer's, an aluminum intake in the body is somehow related. Studies have refuted that, so the jury is still out on that.
We go now to Stella from Flushing. Stella?
Yes, hi. I need you to help in a family dispute. The pot washer in my house insists on putting cold water into hot pots or pans or skillets that are laminated, and I say this is going to cause them to delaminate.
I hate to get involved in marital problems, but the answer is you're right.
I'm right.
Never, ever, ever put a hot pot in cold water, because what really will happen is the bottom of the skillet, for example, will warp, and the center ends up becoming higher than the edges very often. So, no, bad idea.
Okay, I'm going to play this tape tonight when he comes home. So he can hear the evidence.
This is like car talk. Okay. So, all the best.
But, the carburetor works better when you douse it in cold water.
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you for calling.
Pleasure. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
And Jill from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about chocolate. Every year for the holidays, I make a Hungarian cookie that's about an inch and a half diameter that gets totally dipped. The top gets totally dipped in chocolate. I have trouble melting the chocolate so that it's thin enough to actually do that coating. And when I try to mix it with something like coffee to thin it out, it seizes up. Is there any way to do that to make it thin enough to spread?
Well, it's a good question. Coffee will chocolate will sometimes seize with a tiny bit of moisture in it. But sometimes if you add more liquid to it and whisk it over heat, for example, take a bowl, put it over a saucepan with about a half an inch of simmering water. That's how I would melt the chocolate, or in a microwave at 50% power. And you can add more liquid to it, and sometimes adding more liquid to it will solve the seizing problem.
Just keep going with it.
Yeah, just add a little bit more and see what happens. But I would try 50% power in a microwave, chop it, put it in a bowl, in the microwave glass bowl, and try 50% power, and then add a little bit of liquid there. That might work.
Great.
Okay, thank you for calling us. And so it's obvious you're not one of those microwave purists.
The only thing I use it for is heating maple syrup. And heating maple syrup. I think that's about it.
You said melt chocolate. Butter as well.
You can make a quick polenta, cornmeal mush for breakfast in about 5 minutes in it. So that, there are a few things.
Yeah. Well, Barbara Kafka years ago,
I remember the book.
Published a book in which she claimed it was really good for certain kinds of things that involve steaming vegetables, fish.
Microwave Gourmet. That was the book.
But you don't go along with that?
Well, I tested a lot of her recipes at one time, and they worked well. But the only problem I found was that it's easier to manage something on a stovetop because you don't have to take it in and out of an oven and take the plastic top off. So it's actually easier for me to steam on top of the oven stovetop than it is in a microwave.
Cooks often want to impress guests, and so they will cook something really fancy that they found in a cookbook. Do you think that's a good idea? Is it better to cook something you have worked on before?
You know, it's a great question. Over the years, when I've been lucky enough to cook with people who've cooked all their lives, they always cook simply, and they cook something that they've cooked a million times before. So the biggest mistake people make is they go out, create a fancy menu, too many things on the menu, things they've never cooked before. You know, for example, for Christmas Day, we have some French family over, and we cook something very simple. You know, I might cook chicken noodle soup or something, or a simple stew. So if those of us who lived in Boston for years were invited to Julia's house for dinner or lunch, and she'd have one thing with some bread and lots of wine. That would be it. So keep it simple, sure.
Of course, if the wine is really good, you don't even notice if there aren't
and anything. If the conversation's good, yes.
My guest is Chris Kimball, whose latest book, or at least his team's latest book, is called The Complete America's Test Kitchen TV Show Cookbook, 2001-2010. Every recipe from 10 years of the TV show with product ratings and a look behind the scenes. We will continue this conversation and look into some of the horror stories that people sent us as we continue this show. Stay with us. Our number, by the way, 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Oh, and one other thing. We have recipes from the Complete America's Test Kitchen TV Cookbook on our show page at WNYC.org. You might want to check those out as well. We're back with Chris Kimball and your calls at 212-433-9692. His latest book, or America's Test Kitchen's latest book, is The Complete America's Test Kitchen TV Show Cookbook, 2001-2010, published by America's Test Kitchen. You also have a number of magazines covering a wide range of things. But this grows out of cooks, doesn't it? Because you were looking for perfect recipes in cooks, and you take us in that magazine through the whole process of why we tried this way. We cooked it at 400 degrees, then we tried 375, then we went up to 500, that sort of thing, and eventually coming up with a recipe that you think is pretty much going to work for everybody.
Well, this is what Julia Child did for years and years. She used to test a recipe 20 or 25 times and dig deep into the structure of it. That's what we tried to do. You know, I started cooks in 1980. In the 1993, I relaunched it without any advertising, and it gave us more room to write 2,000 words about why it's the perfect fudgy brownie. And the, you know, I really thought we'd have maybe 100,000 readers. I mean, that was my goal, and it went far beyond that. And that's, I guess, people really love to understand why. It's like everything else, but they want to understand it. They don't want to just be told how to do it.
Well, I understand that, because I think that one of the problems that many people face today is that cookbooks became very much a follow what I tell you. using one teaspoon plus a scant more for this and then do this and do that with no idea of why you were doing it. And cooking in the old days used to be people understanding the whole process of cooking. In fact, cookbooks in the old days never gave you exact measurements.
No. It wasn't until I just spent a lot of time researching the 19th century, and it wasn't really till the 1890s when, if you looked at the local newspapers, they would start having more serious recipes. But the recipes had no numbers. They'd say, if you did a pie, they'd say, make a paste. Well, that was the word for pie pastry. They wouldn't even give you the recipe. But by the time Mary Lincoln and Fanny Farmer came along, 1880s and 90s, they started to have, you could go out in the cookware store or a store and buy measuring cups, which was a big thing. And once the cookware industry started creating that stuff, by 1900 you could actually measure. But it went in the other direction, which is the recipes didn't explain. And the problem was people didn't know. I mean, the big thing 100 years ago was people had 50 recipes. People weren't making thousands of recipes. And they didn't go to the hot new Brazilian restaurant Tuesday night. They want to cook it Saturday night. And so because there was a familiarity with a very limited range of cooking at home, you didn't need instruction. Now, if someone has never made, a faux soup before, well, you know, people grow up in that part of the world. They know a lot about faux soups, but you may not. So you do need a lot of instruction.
But how consistent are the ingredients we're working with? If I buy a bag of unsifted flour, let's say, am I getting pretty much the same no matter what the brand is?
It's a good question because no. If you buy Pillsbury Gold Medal, the protein content is around 10.5%. If you buy King Arthur, it's about 11.9%.
So that's going to affect and how it could, the thing comes out?
It could. That's why we actually, although we love King Arthur, that's why we do test with Pillsbury Gold Medal because that's what most people use. So yeah, it could definitely affect it. And how you measure the flour, if you dip and sweep, which you take a 1-cup measure, put it in the bag, sweep it off the top, some people will get 5 ounces, which is the appropriate weight for a cup of flour. Some people get 4.5, et cetera. So even how you measure it at home will make a huge difference.
Rose Levy Birnbaum pointed that out when she did the Cook Bible and
the Cake Bible,
and she did everything by weight rather than by cups and other kinds of measurements.
Including baking powder. Yeah. She actually weighed her baking powder. But she was right, because if you want consistent results, she was the first person to really push that heavily here in America.
Let's take another call. We go to Janet from Katona. Hi, Janet. You're on the air.
I'm right here. Thank you very much for taking my call. Hello, Leonard. Hello, Chris.
Hi.
I have a burning question.
A burning question?
Not at all. I mean, I'm anxious to ask this question about, I've been baking for many years and baking cheesecakes for at least 30, and all recipes, and I'm not a recipe follower usually, call for setting the cheesecake at about 425 for 15 minutes and then lowering it anywhere from 300 up to 350. Inevitably, it always cracks on the top. I don't get that beautiful brown, uncracked top. And luckily, people prefer it with strawberries and a glaze, apricot glaze, or kiwi. So I get around it. They don't know that it's cracked underneath. Is there a way to get that nice bakery look?
Yeah, what's happening is like overcooking scrambled eggs. At some point, the liquid just comes out, and that's because your cheesecake, the very top, is reaching a temperature in excess of 160 degrees.
Okay.
So all you have to do is buy a good instant read thermometer and then take it and take a measurement in the top half inch or so, top inch, and when that reaches 160, 155 to 160, get it out of the oven. And let
so
it sit.
It's towards the end that it happens, not at the beginning that I thought. When it reaches a certain temperature. Yeah.
I would probably start it at a lower temperature than 425 as well.
Okay, yeah. And forget about letting it sit.
And do you also use itself. Do you use a water bath for it?
No, never. I'm a quick cook, but I should.
Well, put 2 layers of foil around it and stick it in a water bath, a slightly bigger pan, about 2 inches of water, and that'll also stop it from overcooking.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
What's your thought about pumpkin? Because I swear by using real pumpkins.
Oh, you're one of those.
I'm one of those. Everybody says it tastes the same whether you use canned or real pumpkin, but I can taste the difference, or at least I imagine that I taste the difference.
I've done it with real pumpkin. I like canned better. I'm sorry. No, it's great, but we actually did, we use candied yams, canned candied yams and canned pumpkin as a combination, which I like. But it's very different. Either you like it or you don't. Mm. But it's a lot more work, obviously.
Yeah, well, you just roast them. You cut them. The hard part is cutting the pumpkins open because the skin is pretty thick. We go now to Sheila from Garrison in Putnam County. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I have a question about pressure cookers. My husband sort of wants to buy me this pressure cooker for Christmas, and I remember my mother's from the days where you thought it would blow up. And I wonder, do you like pressure cookers, and what do you use them for? And while I'm on the phone, I read Cook's Magazine all the time, and I would suggest, though, that you have a description of the calorie count when you give us your recipes.
Well,
I think that would be very helpful.
To answer your second question first, while I'm still running the magazine, there won't be calorie counts. I'm really against that idea because it makes you think that food's going to kill you. So unless you have a serious health problem. So I'm really not in favor of that, unless it's a low-fat cookbook or it's specifically a healthy cookbook. I just like to take that notion off the table, but that's just my quirky personality. And the other question was what again?
It was what?
What would you use them for? Do you like them?
Pressure cookers.
Oh, pressure cookers. Yeah, sorry. I'm getting old. About 15 years ago, 20 years ago, they completely changed the design of pressure cookers. So you don't have to worry about the thing exploding or the beans on the ceiling. They're perfectly safe now. They're very easy to use. They're fabulous for cooking stews or meat very quickly, like a pot roast. As long as you don't fill it too much, they're great at cooking beans, which take a long time to cook. A previous caller was asking about cheesecake. I've cooked a cheesecake in a pressure cooker. Thank you very much.
Wow.
Which was great, except I couldn't get it out.
It was
very hard to get it out.
What about slow cookers?
Slow cookers are fabulous. I use a KitchenAid slow cooker, and I've been totally converted to slow cooking, not because the food's better. It forces you to cook in the morning so dinner's all done. So I don't think the food's better. It's just a way of organizing your kitchen time. So go ahead and get a pressure cooker. They're perfectly safe.
Thomas from Brooklyn asks, what's the best budget chef's knife out there? He's looking for something below $50, preferably.
The knife we use in the kitchen and the winner of almost every test over the last 10 years is the Forchner Fibrox, F-I-B-R-O-X, Victorinox knife. It's about $22, $23. It has a great handle. It's got a nice grip to it. Fabulous knife, cheap. We have about 30 of them in the test kitchen.
Elise in Manhattan says, I want to make fish in a salt, but I've been unsuccessful in getting the salt to turn solid during the baking process. Any hints?
Yeah, don't do it. I did this back in the 80s. I did a whole story on fish and salt, and the concept was that it would keep it nice and moist, but there are plenty of ways to cook fish quickly and easily without worrying about salt crust.
But could you also mix it with egg whites, and wouldn't that work? Wouldn't that make it hard?
Yeah, but the question is, why would you do it? I think the salt crust idea was when you had a fire and you didn't have lots of cooking utensils and you needed a way to cook fish and keep it moist. With today's cookware and the stovetop, there's really no reason to do it.
Jonathan in Brooklyn left a question on our show page. Con Ed is now advertising on the subways that if you use glass cookware, you can turn the temperature down 25 degrees.
That's something that's an old wives' tale. It depends on the recipe. Sometimes that's true. Sometimes it's not. I would say in general, I wouldn't change the temperature of the oven. It just depends on what you're cooking. I grew up with that same information, but I don't think it's true.
Marie from White Plains. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I would like to know how you can determine whether or not a chicken is stringy when you look at it raw. And if you can't tell, when you're cooking, is there something you can do to prevent the chicken from being stringy?
Yeah, I don't think it's a function of the chicken itself. I think it's probably a function of overcooking it. And I assume, so the white meat should be 160 to 165.
No, I'm talking about all dark meat and cooked the same way all the time. I have a particular recipe that I would cook for a king. It turns out perfectly. But if the meat is stringy, it's stringy.
I guess the question is when you go, unless you really trust the butcher, if you go to a supermarket, you never know whether one chicken is any better than the other.
Well, the two answers. First of all, if you cook the dark meat for a long time, which you can do because it has fat in it, the longer you cook it, the stringier it will get. I mean, that's just what happens to it. So it may be a function of that. As far as quality, Bell & Evans, I mean, the brands, Bell & Evans is very good. Empire frozen chicken actually is excellent. So those are two brands, and you'll end up with a consistent product.
Tony in Brooklyn asks, any tips on broiling scallops? We have tried to get them crisp without much success. We've covered them in flour and used an iron skillet under the broiler ahead to heat it up in on a normal gas range. But we still get the scallops still come out soft and having lost a fair degree of moisture.
Yeah. First thing to do is don't buy wet scallops. Some scallops have extra moisture in them and some don't. And so if you can get all natural scallops, that makes a huge difference because that moisture in the scallop prevents browning. Secondly, I wouldn't broil them. I'd do them in a big skillet, use a ton of heat, put a little bit of olive oil and butter in it, make sure that pan's real hot, and don't fill the pan. Don't crowd the pan with too many scallops at a time, and then flip them over. You get great browning.
Now, there are places in Chinatown where you can get scallops in the shell at this time of year. Do you think it's any better?
Yeah, the wet scallops, these are scallops that have been treated. Those scallops are worthless for sautéing, as I said, because moisture, anytime you sauté chicken, meat, scallops, fish, if there's a wet surface, that moisture has to disappear before you can actually brown the food underneath it. It acts as a barrier. So, as Lay said, yeah, you make sure you have real scallops that are not been treated, untreated scallops, and you'll be all set. Again, use a very hot pan. Put about 2 teaspoons of oil in the pan. Heat it up. When that oil just starts to smoke, if you add a little butter, and then saute, but make sure you get enough heat going.
Oh, another listener asks, when you weigh flour, is the weight affected by the humidity in the air and other environmental factors?
We thought that was true. We tested it. One of our insane MIT grads tested this notion, and it turns out, no, it didn't really affect it. All-purpose flour is 5 ounces. Cake flour should be about 4 ounces per cup.
We go now to Eric from the Bronx. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a big fan, by the way. One of those very expensive all-clad stainless steel roasting pans. And before I swap it in for your recommended $100 and under roasting pan, The sidewalls have developed like a rust-colored residue that I cannot get off with Barkeeper's Friend or any of the other recommended products. And I'm wondering if you had any tips for getting off. The bottom is still stainless steel, looks perfectly fine, cooks perfectly fine, but I can't get the residue off the sidewall.
I was going to suggest use Barkeeper's Friend, but that's the best I can do. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with cookware that looks like it's used, I guess unless you're trying to return it. So a lot of my cookware is not perfect looking, and I'm sure Julia Child had a lot of cookware that looked old too, so it's not going to affect cooking. So,
thank you for calling us. James from Montclair, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, yes, thank you so much. A new stove, we were thinking about 2000 or so. What would you recommend?
You're talking about an entire stove?
Yeah, he says the stove died.
First of all, you can use gas or electric. Electric is fine. You're talking about a range with a stove top or just a stove?
A range with combo.
Two things to look for. Does the broiler turn off if it gets too hot? That is, can you open the door and leave the broiler on is the first thing I look at. And secondly, what's the British thermal unit, BTU output of the range? The cooktop, I would try to go for about 15,000, 12 to 15,000 if you can get it. Those are the two things to look for. Gas or electric, doesn't matter.
But I would demand something else because I've had both kinds of stoves. I like the ovens where you push a button and in gas stoves and get it up to 350 degrees. It tells you when it's 350 degrees because when you do it with the dial, unless you have a really great oven thermometer, you have no idea of what you're really cooking at.
Well, I would add, buy a $14 Taylor oven thermometer because inevitably your oven's going to be off even if it's new.
What about convection ovens? A listener wants to know.
We have convections. Convections are good for things like roast chicken, for bread, They're terrible. Cookies, they're terrible for things like cakes, where they dry out the top of the cake. The cake won't rise properly because of that. So, and there is no universal rule for saving time. But for cookies, cookies in particular, you don't have to move the sheets around. It'll give you much more even cooking.
Chris Kimball's the publisher of Cooks Magazine, Country Cooking. What else?
Cook's Country.
Yes. Cook's Country.
Cook's Illustrated, Cook's Country, and then we have the two TV shows, America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country as well.
And the latest book is the complete America's Test Kitchen TV show cookbook. Chris will be talking with Jack Bishop tonight, inviting audience members on stage at 8:15 at the 92nd Street Y. For ticket information, go to our show page at WNYC.org. And thank you so much for being on our show today.
A great pleasure. Great to see you.